This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of 12 Truths Every Teen Can Trust, Core Beliefs of the Christian Faith That Will Change Your Life, written by Paul David Tripp. Most of you have probably read one of Paul's books, pastor, best-selling author. This accessible book, Paul examines 12 core doctrines of the Christian faith, and as you know from Tripp's writing, he's always going to apply them to the heart, in this case, to the teen's heart and life. Talk about justification, God's sovereignty, glorification, creation, salvation. So pick up a copy, 12 Truths Every Teen Can Trust, wherever books are sold, or you can visit crossway.org/12truthsforteens. And you can sign up for a free Crossway Plus account and get 30% off your next order. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast. Coming up in February, Bethlehem College and Seminary will host its 38th annual Serious Joy Conference. This year's theme is Word and Spirit, the Power of Supernatural Ministry. I am speaking at the conference. It's always a good idea to go to Minneapolis in January or February if you can. The weather may be cold, but the fellowship will be warm, and I've always enjoyed going to this conference and sometimes having the opportunity to speak at it. John Piper, Stephen Lee, Mark Vrogup, David Mathis, others will be speaking and exploring a unique facet of supernatural ministry and breakout tracks that you can choose from: church-centered missions, church planning, biblical theology. Learn more about the conference and consider registering at Bethlehem College and Seminary's website, bcsmn.edu. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. Kevin DeYoung, senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. Matthew's right next to Charlotte. And I am joined today by my special guest, John Wilsey. And just learned, John, is you're from Atlanta? Is that where you were born?
That's where I'm from. I was actually born on a naval station in Newport, Rhode Island, but I only lived there for a month because my father was discharged from the Navy right after I was born. So Atlanta is my mother's hometown, and we moved back home for her. And I might as well have been born there because I spent the vast majority of my childhood and teenage years there. Yeah.
My father-in-law, he's now with the Lord, but was 30 plus years in the Navy. So my wife lived at some point in Newport there.
Yeah.
It's one of the familiar naval stops.
I've never been back.
Since you were born there. Well, she was born in California and, you know, doesn't remember anything about that and moved after a few months and then lived up and down the East Coast. But you went to Furman, MDiv, PhD, Southeastern Baptist. Now you teach at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
Yes, sir.
And we're going to talk about this wonderful book. I read it right when it came out, Religious Freedom, A Conservative Primer. But give us just a little bit more of your background and what you teach at Southern and your interest in this particular topic.
Yeah, thanks for asking. And thanks a lot for having me on, Kevin. I really appreciate it. For 20 years or thereabouts, I was, before I became an academic, I was a school teacher in Christian schools and a Christian school principal at two different schools. I taught everything from 3rd through 11th grade, all the grades from 3rd to 11th grade in my teaching career. And I also served on pastoral staff as a youth pastor and as pastor of spiritual formation at First Baptist Church of Charlottesville, Virginia. And we were there at that church for a total of 11 years, and I was on pastoral staff there for 8 of those years. And then I finished my PhD in 2010. And when I finished my PhD, I'd first begun to study under the supervision of L. Russ Bush III, who was the dean of the faculty at the time. And unfortunately, he came down with cancer while I was in my program, and he died right when I was in the middle of my program. So that was very sad. It was a great loss. But I did graduate in 2010. In 2011, I went to Southwestern Seminary to teach history and philosophy. And I taught at Southwestern for 6 years. And in 2017 and 18, I spent that year as a visiting fellow at the Madison program at Princeton, where I did research on my biography of John Foster Dulles. And it was that same year also that I went to Southern to teach. So I've been at Southern now for, this is my ninth year. And my wife, Mandy, and I met in when I was in seminary. She just graduated from Chapel Hill. And we've been married for 28 and a half years. And we have two daughters, 20 years old and 16 years old.
And where are they at? Are they in, is 20-year-old in college?
The 20-year-old is at Boyce. She's a junior.
Oh, good.
And
Not too far away.
that's good. Yep. And my 16-year-old daughter is a junior in high school. And I should also mention that we're members of Kenwood Baptist Church in Louisville, where I also serve as a lay elder.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So we have lots of mutual friends, we were just saying,
We
and we've
do.
met maybe once or twice. We met at Carl Truman's Erasmus lecture at the famous, or hoity-toity sounds negative, but higher class than me,
He
certainly,
was very high class, very high
Union
class.
League in
Yeah.
Manhattan. You were saying you're not a fan of all of the Union generals, at least not Sherman, with your upbringing in Atlanta.
That's true. That's true. I'm a fan of General Grant, but Tecumseh Sherman's not one of my favorite people.
Oh, he's a good Midwestern boy. We won't talk about him. Before we get into the specifics of this book, and I'm really happy to be talking to you, John. We have lots of, not, I just said mutual friends. We also have we're interested in a lot of the same things. So I've enjoyed reading your not only your books but some of your book reviews. And so I want to and articles online. I want to ask a couple of macro questions first. So first about history and the state of the Guild Evangelical Historians. Are you still a part of the Conference of Faith and History?
I am still a member.
So
Yes.
I'm a member. I'm not involved, but a member and get the journal. What's your sense of where things are at? I know you have lots of friends in there, and probably some of them you agree with, and some of them you know and don't agree with. But the question behind the question is, sort of the generation down from Marsden, Knoll, those were the father figures, and now some of maybe either students or just second, that next generation, Gen X and our sort of age, seems to have been, although maybe it's died down a little bit in the last couple of years, but have taken on more of an activist kind of scholarship. Where it has seemed to me like many of the, lack of a better term, progressive edge on some things are were coming through history academics. How do you size up the state of the evangelical historian profession? And are you encouraged or discouraged?
Yes, that's a good question, and I think your assessment of the CFH is exactly right.
I
I
like
was
that
there.
cat.
Yeah,
We
he's
have a giant fat orange cat. It looks
he's
like you have one.
yes. You know, everybody should have one. They're great fun. So the CFH is exactly as you described it. The meeting that was held in 2022 at Baylor, I do think that was the sort of the climactic moment of the progressive aspect or the progressive wing of the CFH. They had their they had their that was probably the apex of their the or the high watermark of their influence. And it was a terribly uncomfortable conference to be at. Not just because I don't just say that just because I'm a conservative. I think that a lot of people, no matter kind of what their views were, felt that way. there was a very strong emphasis on activist history at that particular meeting. Kristen Dumais, Jamar Tisby were the two plenary speakers for the conference, and that was that was their advocacy there. But the next meeting that took place in 2024 was much milder with regard to that. It was much more focused on history. I would still classify the CFH as being dominated by those to the left of me anyway. But the emphasis on activist history and the need for activist history was a little less pronounced in 2024, and I do hope that that trend continues. And the reason why that's true is that the people like Kristen Dumais and Jamar Tisby weren't there. They didn't come. I think if they had been there, if they had shown up and taken the trouble to show up, then it would have been more of an emphasis on that. But it wasn't, and I think it's because they weren't there. Whether they have an interest in returning it is another story. Now, with regard to more broadly speaking, I still think that I think that evangelical historical scholarship is, I think it's generally still trending on the progressive sort of track, and I want to see. I hope to see that would change. I hope to see that the influence of historians like Alan Gelzo would
My last
gain
guest
a
on the
stronger.
podcast.
I saw that. Yes, I'm so glad you had him. He his is a very good voice, very needed voice in historical scholarship, especially among historians. And very glad to see that you had him on, and may his tribe increase.
Well, thank you for giving that, and you're almost convincing me that I need to think about coming to a CFH
Well,
meeting,
you
but
should come. I tell my conservative friends all the time, you need to come. If you don't come, then we're not going to have any voice. So it's important to come. And we do have, you and I both have mutual friends at CFH, and you would not feel isolated or cornered at all. I don't think there. There's a lot of good historians there, and even some of the historians that are more to the left are still, many of them are excellent historians. They're not doing politics, even though they're on the progressive side. So
So
that's important.
let me ask the second macro question, which is will lead into your book. You do talk about Christian nationalism in this book, and you have a detailed critique of Stephen Wolfe's book, and I've written a long review when the work came out as well. And I don't want to mainly talk about Stephen Wolfe's book, but the PCA, as I'm sure you know, has a study committee now looking at Christian nationalism. As the moderator of the PCA currently, I selected the members for that committee and tried to give enough breadth of intellectual diversity within the PCA and within, not so much diversity that people aren't going to find some common ground. But I'm optimistic that they're going to produce a really good work. What's your sense of that larger conversation on Christian nationalism? Do you see more heat than light, or are we having the right sorts of conversations, or is it overtaken by just political machinations on X? Are you optimistic about this producing something helpful and theologically, historically rich? How do you see the conversation playing out around CN?
Yeah, well, I think one thing is that it's shown its durability. It's not going away. There are I have friends and they're mutual friends, I'm sure that we share, that initially said, "Oh, this is just a flash in the pan. This very few people hold to this view. It's not that important. It's going to go away." And I have always believed it was very deeply rooted in Christian circles and conservative Christian circles, and I think that that's demonstrated in the fact that y'all in the PCA are dealing with it in a very serious way. In the Baptist Convention, we're still dealing with it as well. I've been asked to write a resolution at the SBC a couple of years. I haven't gotten around to doing it because I had other things going on, but it's still very much a live issue in my circles as well. And I think with Trump coming in 2024, it's only given it more energy and more momentum. I think that I do think that most of the conversation is happening on social media. I think social media is what gives it most of its life. If you didn't have social media, I think it might have been true that it would have been a flash in the pan, but I think social media does fuel it. Given the nature of social media, that one is able to rashly reveal the depths of one's innermost parts of their conscience on social media is one of the reasons why it gives it life.
One of and I've given this a lot of thought, and it's so I have a lot of ideas. There's still I need to find time to write some of them down. So it's maybe not half baked, but maybe three quarter baked. But one of the ways I think about it is, and you can tell me if you agree and feel free to disagree, but I think let's say on one pole, and let's just call it to the left, the critique of Christian nationalism would be everyone who's a Christian nationalist, they're an insurrectionist, they're a January Sixer, they want to see, absolute, they want theocratic control of America and the worst, dystopian Handmaid's tale. So you have that sort of critique, which I think fits very, very few people who are animated by Christian nationalism.
Agreed.
If you go to the other pole, there are people both, whacks and serious academic people. So let's deal with the serious people who are saying, now, wait a minute, the magisterial reformers, or isn't this the Protestant mainstream tradition that the civil magistrate is ordained by God to lead people to the common good, and the common good is their highest spiritual good, and some kind of civil magistrate that is pursuing these Christian ends. And for some of these people, some of whom would be our friends, and some of whom, as I say, are really nasty online, but that's not everyone,
No.
right? Who's arguing for this at
Yeah.
all? So I want to be
Right, right,
fair.
right.
But would say maybe we need a church establishment. Maybe the First Amendment was a mistake. Now, I also think, maybe this is wishful, I also think that though there are some very smart voices on that side, the number of rank and file Christians in the PCA, in the SBC, who think the First Amendment was a mistake, that kind of language is going to be very also small, and that the vast swath of people in kind of the middle think Christian nationalism, whether they would use the term or not, they think, wow, I loved that at the Charlie Kirk service, we had our high-ranking officials giving voice, some of them quite eloquently, some less so, to the Christian gospel. I want to see Christian influence. I want to see this be a Christian country where we return to our Christian values. And there's a lot of gray area for what that means. But my sense is most of the people who get animated by that's what they have in mind. And that's a very consistent theme throughout American history. A return to, a kind of Christian America. And you can find modernists and fundamentalists saying that same thing at the
Oh,
beginning of the
yeah.
20th century. And you would
Sure.
know that better than I would, your history into John Foster Dulles. So I think what happens then with that vast swath of people in the middle is they're not quite sure. So they got these people who are maybe now calling for more of a, a Christian prince, or they're calling for maybe church establishment, or you know what? Why should we? If Buddhists are idolaters and Hindus are idolaters, maybe why should they have religious freedom in our country? And I don't think they've really thought that through. I think their main impulse is, I love Jesus, I love America, I want more Jesus in America, and the details are really up for grabs. That's sort of my three buckets. How do you see the lay of the land? And feel free to get into your book, because you're talking about some of these very same things.
Well, I'll start by responding. I read a very interesting Substack post from my good friend Daniel K. Williams last week, and he deserves a lot of credit for coming up right for writing this article, because I think it was very astute and very insightful on his part. He was tackling that this very question of civil religion, and his observation, in short, was that for most of American history, at least in the 20th century, for sure, civil religion in America was sort of was parallel to sort of mainline American Christianity. So, when we think about someone like Eisenhower or Dulles or even Kennedy, who in his inaugural address, he's a Roman Catholic, but it was very strong civil religious motifs that he used that can be embraced by, sort of the Protestant Catholic Jew, which was certainly in 1961, that was American culture. So think mainline Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, if you will. But what Dan said in his article was that we've seen a shift for the last 20 years in American civil religion, that it's much more evangelical now. In that regard, it is more narrow. It's not as broad. It's not as sort of embracing of a wider cultural movement. It's more narrow. It's more specific, because it's articulating a more specific kind of Christianity as a civil religion. And he pointed out the Kirk Memorial Service as an example. I think that that's right. I think that he's absolutely right about that. I think that American civil religion is taking on a more evangelical flavor. And I think there's good things and bad things with that. I mean, the good things are obvious that such a civil religion is much more friendly to the way that evangelicals see the world. And if, I will say that I'm an evangelical, and I see the world like evangelicals do, broadly speaking. But in a negative sense, it's a lot harder to cultivate a civic unity around a civil religion that's more narrow. And so what Dan says in his piece is that you can expect more partisanship, more division as civil religion is further defined in an evangelical sense. So that remains to be seen, but I think that I suspect that he might be right about that.
What did you talked about strengths and weaknesses. So just think about what many of our listeners would have seen or read about the Kirk Memorial Service. What did you think, and think like a historian? Because I was saying to somebody, it made a big difference. Did you, if we looked at that memorial service as a political rally, which had some wonderful religious speeches, or if you looked at it as a religious service, almost entirely co-opted by a political angle. I think you can make the case for either one of those, which speaks to some of its strengths and potential dangers. You and I probably both know folks who might see it as, certainly some, the people in the CFH would just be alarmed and see it as all of the fears coming true. You and I would both have a lot of friends who would see almost nothing except good in that service. How do you assess what was good and what dangers Christians might want to be aware of from a service like that.
Yeah. Well, on the positive side, I am not a cynic. So I well, at least I don't think I'm a cynic. Maybe someone would describe me as that way, but I don't think I am. Thinking about it historically, I think that the analogs to the Charlie Kirk Memorial Service could be, funerals, public funerals that we've had. Not just presidents, but political leaders like FDR's funeral, John Foster Dulles's funeral, which was the largest funeral in Washington's history at that point, 1959, the Kennedy funeral, Billy Graham's
Billy
funeral.
Graham here in Charlotte, yep.
The difference is that Kirk was not a political figure in the sense that he was an office holder. He was not. He did talk about politics, but he was a cultural leader. He was a religious leader, but he was a cultural leader. He cared about cultural issues from a Christian worldview perspective, and he was someone that was nationally recognized. But it was because, I think, of his exposure as a result of the internet and his organization, social media, and so forth, which is unique. It's different. It's different than anything that's gone before. With regard to the content of the memorial service, you would expect a memorial service to be laden with religious content. You would want that. If it didn't have what it had, then something would be wrong. Something would be terribly wrong with that. I don't object at all because the context was a memorial service. And so there needed to be a great deal of religious theological content with that. And I thought it was entirely appropriate. What's sad is that that this couldn't have been a chance for greater unity among Americans in general. Even if Charlie Kirk was not someone's cup of tea, someone could still appreciate that this man was being honored. He was a patriot. He loved his family. He was devoted to them. He was devoted to his country. He's a Christian, solid Christian, obviously a lover of God. These are things that you would think that people could appreciate, even if they didn't personally like him or personally, buy into his agenda. The cynicism, I think, it is unique to our generation, to our culture, I think, in a historical sense. There have been times in our history when cynicism has been strong and partisanship has been strong. But I do think there's a unique aspect to it because I do think that technology, social media, 24-hour news coverage, the internet, these things are not helpful. I think that these things are bad for our civic life and for our church life as well.
One of the things, now that's all very well said. One of the things I think about, I can even go back and look at maybe sermon that I would do 20 years ago. So I've been in ministry now for over 23 years. And I do think 15 or 20 years ago, I could maybe see in some sermons, if I were to say something about civil religion, it would only be bad. I only would say something about the danger of civil religion. Don't mistake that for a genuine born again heart, a genuine relationship with Jesus. The gospel is not the same thing as the American dream. All of which is true. What I think I've learned and others is it's one thing when you have a civil religion to talk very negatively about it. When you lose it, you think, oh, well, that did some things that we really need because a culture must be bound together by
By
something. I mean,
something.
by something. You have to have some shared historical narrative, some general sense. So I think it's not wrong to see that there has been an effort to make the LGBTQ flag agenda, make that the civil religion, for sure. So it's not nature abhors a vacuum. You're not
That's
just
right.
gonna all. So I think I have been chastened in that to see that there's something good about a cultural Christianity, which is very different from, or I should say, a Christian culture rather than a cultural Christian. We want genuine Christians. So all of that is to be chastened. At the same time, I now also find myself wanting to sound some of those familiar notes to some of my friends and say, let us not forget that the Great Commission was not to save Western civilization. The Great Commission was not to do something about one particular nation, but in fact, Jesus relativizes that. And I don't think the exegesis that said we're baptizing nations qua nations has a historical pedigree or is exegetically warranted. I think that text means, as most Christians have always assumed it to mean, those from individual nations. In that way, the nations are brought to Christ, not qua nations. So I want to remind, some of my conservative friends, and I'm a conservative as you are, let's not lose sight of the story that God is writing in the world, which is the story of the church. And there's only one institution that we know is going to make it to the end of human history, and that's the church. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but feel free to agree, disagree. Do you see some of those same civil religion, yes, no tensions in your own thinking?
Most definitely. Let's go on. In 2015, I had my book American Exceptionalism, Civil Religion come out. And it when I wrote that book, I was thinking along the lines you just explained. Back in those days, I was concerned about the David Bartons of the world, the Robert Jeffresses of the world that want to say we were founded as a Christian nation, offer this declension narrative. We've fallen from our evangelical roots. David Barton, famous for saying that Thomas Jefferson is an evangelical Christian, has a whole book on it. And so I wanted to kind of offer a corrective to that. But over the course of the 10 years since then, I've found that a lot of evangelicals, a lot of Christian people have overcorrected, kind of in the way that you've described. And so I sort of have wanted to have a recovery of that. And I think it is true that Jesus did not come to save Western civilization. But I would say too that it is Western civilization that's been defined by
The
Christianity.
Christianity. Right.
And
That's
so
why I just had Alan Gelso on to talk about the
I
Western
talked about the very
tradition.
thing. To talk about that very thing. And so whenever we talk about Western civ we've just passed Columbus Day, and I was very gratified to see several defenses of Columbus Day and of Columbus's legacy. People like Daniel McCarthy, for example, wrote some really good pieces on that. Western civilization, I don't think, is at all the same as the church, but Western civilization has been good for us, and I think that it's good to conserve that as much as possible.
I want to take a moment to thank Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary for their support of the podcast. You are invited, you meaning church leader listening to this, your family, invited to the annual confessional conference hosted by Greenville Seminary. The theme for this year's conference, which will take place in March, so it's the upcoming conference for 2026, The Church, the Bride of Christ. Speakers include Ian Hamilton, Jonathan Master, Michael Morales, Mike Riccardi, Rhett Dodson, David Irving, many others. And whether you are new to Reform teaching, or you want to go to a conference that's friendly for the family, or you're learning about these things for the 100th time, this is a great option to consider for your spring schedule. Rich teaching, singing, fellowship, as we consider what it means for the church to be the bride of Christ. There's also a children's program provided for kids ages 3 through 11, Bible, catechism, memory, games, lessons. So check it out. Registration rates will soon increase, so be sure to mark your calendar March 10 through 12 and consider registering today at gpts.edu. We also want to mention Reformed Theological Seminary. RTS has several different campuses throughout the country, including right here in Charlotte, where I am one of the professors, and encourage you, if you are looking to be trained in pastoral ministry, you want to grow in your understanding of the Bible and history and theology, to check out RTS. For more than 60 years, RTS has prepared church leaders to be grounded in God's inerrant word, committed to the Reformed faith, shaped by a commitment to the Great Commission and a lifetime of service. Great faculty, great options for degrees and locations in person, which is always the best, but also global, which gives the flexibility many people need. Discover how RTS is equipping the next generation of ministry leaders. Go to rts.edu. Your book, Religious Freedom, talking to John Wilsey, Religious Freedom, a Conservative Primer. So connect those dots for us. What do you mean by conservatism, and how is it related to religious freedom?
Well, defining conservatism is tricky business because everybody has a definition for it. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read a definition that I have here. This is from Peter Viereck. Peter Viereck was a conservative historian. He taught at Mount Holyoke College for 50 years.
What page are
And
you going to, John?
this is page 45.
Okay, I have a lot of underlines in that section,
Well,
so I'm
good,
glad.
good. Peter Viereck was is something of a neglected figure in the history of American conservatism since World War II. He's very helpful, and he has this as a definition for conservatism. He says, "Conservative principles, par excellence, are proportion and measure, self-expression through self-restraint, preservation through reform, humanism and classical balance, a fruitful nostalgia for the permanent beneath the flux, and a fruitful obsession for unbroken historical continuity. These principles together create liberty, a liberty built not on the quicksand of adolescent defiance, but on the bedrock of ethics and law." And I think that is the best definition that I have seen. I think it is concise. It's not wordy. It doesn't go on and on, but I think it captures the essentials of what a conservative disposition looks like. Conservatism is a disposition. It's not first and foremost a conservative, or excuse me, a political ideology. It is. It does involve politics, but it's conservatism as a disposition is far upstream of just mere politics. And I love this definition because it really gets at an attitude, a worldview. And what I try to say in the book is that conservatism is not only dispositional, it's also aspirational, in that ultimately we have to ask ourselves, what kind of a person do I want to be? Do I want to be a virtuous person, or do I want to be a vicious person of vice? And conservatism cultivates virtue, and aspirational conservatism looks to the past, to tradition, to inform what a fully formed conscience should look like. And it also looks ahead to the future, especially to future generations who are going to inherit the world that that my generation will hand down to them. So I think that conservatism involves all of those things.
You write a few pages earlier, page 40, this was helpful. The tensions between conservatism and progressivism can thus be summarized as follows. Is humanity inherently fallible with a tendency towards selfishness, or is human nature essentially good and thus perfectible through purely autonomous human reason, will, or feelings? Should people in a society submit to rule prescribed by traditions and customs handed down to us by our forebears? Or can people create a society anew out of whole cloth in which authority, law, custom, and tradition are non-compulsory? That was very well said. You put on the next pages, perfect equality possible among human beings. Should societies pursue perfect equality by coercion if necessary? And perhaps the most important question of all, can human individuals and societies pursue reform by changing the external realities in human institutions? Or does true reform begin by change in the inner moral life of persons born with a sin nature? These issues are the first principles that will separate a conservative oriented above to the transcendent, behind to the past, around about in the present, and then forward toward the future. Really like all of those points about what a conservative is. It is, as the name suggests, someone who sees there is something to conserve. As you know, I talked to Alan Gelzo in our last episode, and David McCullough makes this same point that history is about a debt of gratitude to the past. There are villains in history for sure, but all of us, especially if we're talking as, you know, in the West and certainly in America, even with all of our problems in 2025, we have to see massive benefits, blessings that have been given to us in these institutions, a prosperity that we did not ourselves create, a freedom that was forged and preserved and protected by others, under assault in some ways, and yet it's a debt of gratitude to the past. And I think that's the best of what a conservative is trying to do, to say, let's look at what has come before and what has worked. Civilization is a fragile thing. And then to your point, you know, what Thomas Sowell calls the, you know, the constrained view of human nature, that we're prone to selfishness. And you know, even better than I do, you know, the founding generation were not of one mind on exactly the state of human nature. And yet, more or less, I think they did share a sense that human nature is prone to selfishness and must be frustrated. You know, famous Federalist 10, Federalist 51, and Madison, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. I think there was a basic Augustinian, even for many of them, explicitly Calvinistic anthropology that said, we can't trust human beings with a lot of power. And if I were to have one of my most serious disagreements with some of the Christian nationalist advocates is I want to say, I don't trust you with the power you want to wield. I don't trust me. I'm much more
No.
like Gandalf looking at the ring. No, don't give me that ring. Let's concede. And I think the genius of the American founding was to say, rather than, this is how I put it sometimes, rather than, what is the best thing that government could do if we all got the best people and we all pursued the greatest, highest, heavenly good? That was not their motivation. They thought, what's the worst thing that fallen people can do? And how can we create a system that will frustrate that? And I think that is what I think is actually a more Christian view of government.
Absolutely, absolutely. To take a realistic view of human nature. If I may say something about my friend Stephen Wolfe's book and his thesis, in Case for Christian Nationalism, the strength of his book is that he has an answer for every objection. You read in his book, and he's very good at anticipating objections, and he has an answer for every single one, and it's impressive. One of my favorite objections is that, well, the Christian prince, the Christian magistrate, what if the Christian magistrate goes awry? What if he turns to abuse the power that is concentrated in his hands? Oh, well, that will never happen, because he will be a biblical Christian. It's ironic that Stephen says that, because Stephen is a Calvinist, and I would think that Stephen has a pretty healthy view of total depravity, except when it comes to the Christian magistrate. Apparently, the Christian magistrate is immune to depravity. I think that's all correct. It's all there in the historical record in terms of our founding. And to depart from that and to place all of a sudden to place trust in our magistrates just because they agree with us, or have the same religious faith as we do, to me, unbelievably naive, and
Right.
also a little bit a little bit even hypocritical to one's own belief system if you're a Calvinist.
And there's a very important distinction between the separation of church and state and the separation of Christianity and public life.
Yeah.
Not arguing for the
Yeah.
latter,
Yeah.
or even denying, why would we want to deny, that Christianity and Protestant Christianity in particular had a privileged place at the founding and really a privileged place well into the 20th century, and you might argue still has a much less, but something of a privileged place. Would I be happy for Protestant Christianity to be a kind of public truth and have a kind of privilege in our culture? Yes.
Yes,
And I
absolutely.
think yes, and I think one of the benefits, one of the strengths, one of the things I appreciate, let's from the Christendom, Christian nationalism side, is their insistence, let's not be afraid to make robust Christian arguments in the public square. That is
Absolutely.
right.
Totally
And
agree.
yeah, and let's not negotiate just negotiate the terms of our own surrender with just a declension narrative. And let's just, as you know, as this whole Christian civilization is sinking under the sea, let's just preserve a few life rafts for us as we go down. I think at a gut level, what appeals to people is a sense of there's something to fight for, and it's worth doing. Here, however, is my pushback, and I'll state it. I'll start with your words here. You're talking about Wolf's book, and you say Wolf's magisterial Christian nationalism is simply incompatible with the American political tradition. Classical liberalism does not orient a nation to its highest good, in part because the individual citizens are not competent to determine what the good is and how to pursue it. And you quote C. Bradley Thompson, who has lots of good stuff, the foundation of moral action and therewith of civilization. In the American tradition, the role of government is not to define and orient the people to the highest good. The role of government is to protect natural rights of the citizens and thus secure their liberties. And I totally agree with that. I don't think the American tradition is the only way, as if it was handed down, and this is the only politically derivative way of organizing a society. I do, however, think it has proved to be durable. I think it has wisdom, and I think it is infused with Christian principles. I don't think it's determinative that this is the Christian way to organize a society. But my concern, and where I see really the rubber meeting the road on some of these Christian nationalism discussions, I want to say, okay, yeah, you say we shouldn't, God is not pleased with idolatry. True, he's not. Let's preach against it. I'm glad we have freedom to preach against it. Well, but in the Old Testament, the king destroyed the idols. Didn't we see some of the, didn't Oliver Cromwell do that? Yes, Oliver Cromwell is going to be a pretty mixed
Yeah,
bag for a lot of people. But I would argue we're not Israel in the Promised Land. And I want to say to, you know, some of my friends in this movement, okay, really, it's one thing to play out, well, this will all happen 250 years from now. Well, that's not really a political philosophy. You're just saying this will take root in 250 years. And I get there's a post-millennialism behind that.
Sure.
But I want to say, what will you do if this kind of idea, let's say 50 years from now, the mood has changed, you're not doing it by, you know, armed revolt, and you have the votes in Congress, do you close down the synagogues? It's a false religion. Do you close down Catholic churches, which Protestants for most of history have considered to be idolatrous worship in some way? Or do you say, well, you know, Catholics and Jews kind of get a grandfather clause. What about Muslims? And what will you do? Where do you send them? Are you sending in the police? I mean, these are legitimate questions. I don't mean them to be reductio ad absurdum. I think if we don't have religious freedom in a country that's the size of a continent with 340 million people, the alternatives, though they can sound very good in the abstract, get quite repressive quickly. How would you respond to that objection that says this liberalism, this Lockean lib, this, and then you put on their post-war consensus that just makes it sound really, really bad. This liberalism has failed. It doesn't work. It's led to the degeneration in our society. And you know what? If Christians aren't wielding this power, somebody else is going to wield this power against us. And if God is angry with it, then I don't want to go against God, and we should get rid of it. We're going to be a Christian nation or a pagan nation. How do you respond to some of those impulses?
I think that that post-liberal critique is too centered on politics and not enough on other historical events, dynamics that have played out in the last 150, 160 years. So my book is heavily Tocquevillian. I know you noticed that. And one of the things that Tocqueville observes in Democracy in America, which I talk about in the book, is the emphasis that he places on the mores of the culture. That is the what he calls the mores. He calls them the habits of the heart of a culture, or he also says the whole moral and intellectual character of the people. We might say customs. We might say culture. He says that the mores ultimately are the source of the laws. The laws are not the source of the mores. Laws are downstream of mores. In other words, laws are downstream of the values that the people hold in a culture. And I think that post-liberals ignore that, ignore the power of culture, the power of mores. So when he came here in the 1830s, he observed that Protestant Christianity was central to the informing the mores. And that's no longer the case. So what happened? I mean, it's a little bit ridiculous now to keep bringing up Alan Gelzo. But Alan Gelzo and Mark Knoll and others have observed that the Civil War is such an enormous cataclysm that destroys the unity of mores that Tocqueville had observed in the 1830s. That after 1865, the sort of monolithic Protestant culture is blown away, largely because the Civil War, this is what Gelzo talks about, largely because the Civil War introduces a theodicy, a question of God's benevolence, God's love, God's power to, protect innocent people, to protect good people. The Civil War was destructive beyond imagination, beyond anybody's expectations. Death was capricious. Death was sudden. Death came to people in ways that that nobody had ever experienced before. And it shook Americans' confidence in providence. In providence, providence had people had put so much confidence in providence before the war, and that confidence was undermined. It would never be the same again. I never hear post-liberals talk about that or gives any kind of analysis to that particular question. And not just the Civil War, but the force of immigration that takes place in the late 19th century, early 20th, the expansion of America into an empire, an overseas empire. World War I, which is a failed Christian nationalist attempt to usher in the kingdom of heaven. This is a Christian nationalist attempt from the left. That's another thing that I think a lot of people miss is that Christian nationalism really emerged from the left in American history. It didn't emerge from the right.
It was Woodrow Wilson. It was absolutely tied, if you want to look, yeah, to more the mainstream Protestant liberalizing modernist wing. I mean, absolutely used the same kind of
Oh yeah.
language because
Oh yeah.
they were the cultural caretakers.
They were. And it was a total failure. A total failure. And so all of these things and a host of other things too contributes to the what historians call the breakup of the Protestant consensus and what we might call here the breakup of Protestant mores. But post-liberals always look to things like post-war consensus or neoliberalism, which are all political or economic forces, and they're not meaningless. But they're far downstream from the breakup of Protestant mores. So I think the real question is, how do you recover that? Well, the way you recover Protestant mores and to have as you've described, a Christian culture is through the unfettered preaching and ministry of the churches. And how is that accomplished? When the government gets out of the way and says, rightly, we have no jurisdiction over the conscience and let the First Amendment do First Amendment things. If the First Amendment was a mistake, then
Then
sure,
America was a
then
mistake. I mean,
America was a
is that,
mistake.
yeah.
Yeah. Then, okay, you can have an established church. For a while, it might be your church. But then, when the next Christian prince comes into power, who's to say it's not going to be Islam and Sharia law? I mean, the logic just takes you off into directions that you do not want to go if you're a post-liberal.
I often think, and I've referenced this before, although I don't know if I've read it directly, but this is from Wilmore Kendall, who was 20th century, more of a populist conservative. But speaking of Daniel McCarthy, that republished this, wrote a foreword to it. But I've always been struck by this. This is Kendall writing in 1963. He's talking about, it's very much to your point, John. He's talking about American conservatism and religion. And he calls it a problem. He said, the problem, put briefly, is this. The United States has been down to now, anyhow, a Christian society governed, or rather self-governed, under a secular constitution. Nothing short of the sea change I mentioned a moment ago is likely to deprive Judeo-Christian religious beliefs of the special status approximating that of a public truth that they enjoy within it. But also, nothing short of such a sea change is likely in the foreseeable future to gain for them a more privileged status than they now enjoy. Attempts to resolve the religious society, secular constitution tension in the United States in either one direction or the other are not only divisive, but contrary to the American tradition itself. They do a poor service both to America and American conservatism, who say and write things that tend to read out of the ranks of conservatives, one or the other. There's a lot there. Don't have to agree with all of it, but it's quite striking. He says in 1963, he says, "Yeah, we still have it's still a Christian society." So one of my ways of trying to understand our present moment is I take what he says there in 1963. He says, "Well, we've always had a Christianity is a public truth, and we've always had that it's religious freedom, religious liberty. It's not going to have more official power than that." And those two things hold in tension. And he says it's always going to be like that. I think what many religious believers are saying now, 60 years later, I think that Christianity as a public truth is gone. You didn't think you thought it would always be there. It's not. And so I think the understandable, though I would argue ultimately misguided response is then to say the other half of the equation, okay, if the one half of the equation, Christianity as a public truth, is gone, then the other part of the equation, which is religious liberty and religious freedom, we don't agree to that end of the bargain either. So the only way to get back to this Christian society is to have something that's more top down, something that is, this Christian prince. I think it's Ross Douthat wrote a couple of years ago, the end of Christendom in First Things, and was saying, okay, that's what we're feeling the loss of, and now what is the response? Is there any explanatory power in what Kendall is saying there with those two things? That we don't have to go all the way to say the Constitution is completely secular. People have argued there's, natural law ideas behind it. But I think on the main, he's right. How do you understand those two things, which he says have always been a part of the American experiment?
Well, I do think that that's right. And I think the question would be, what are we comparing ourselves to? Are we comparing America in 2025 to America in 1963? I mean, if you're going to do that, you can't just consider those two Americas on a one-to-one basis. The culture is changed. Yes, the culture is different. The whole world is so vastly different today in 2025 than it was in 1963, as to almost make any kind of comparison or attempt to compare impossible. Because if you're gonna compare religious life in America, well, then you also have to compare social life. You have to compare technology. You have to compare population, demographics. You have to compare education levels. You have to do it all. You can't just pick one and ignore the rest. It's not a buffet line at Morrison's cafeteria. It's you have this is it's historical comparisons here. And while it preaches well, it doesn't do anything for an audience to say that, to make the comparison. It takes a little bit more intellectual sophistication to make the comparison. Certainly they Certainly, they're right. It's a different religious outlook. Wilmore Kendall's observations don't hold true the same in 2025 as they did in 1963. But there are a lot of things that don't hold true, and some of the things we're glad about. Some things are good that are different about
Black Americans
2025.
wouldn't want to be in
Yeah, no,
1963. The
no.
mainline denominations were at their peak, all ready to be gutted. The SBC, you can tell me, is probably more conservative now than, at least certainly, than it was before the resurgence. The PCA didn't exist. So we don't have to pretend that things, there are no problems. There's huge problems. But we also don't have to tell ourselves everything has only gotten worse. It's as bad as it possibly could be. I was just studying, teaching a Sunday school class this past week on Solzhenitsyn, which is always a good wake-up call to say,
Yeah.
okay, let's just dial back the rhetoric. This is not a totalitarian hellscape that we're living in, like
Yeah.
the Soviet
Yeah.
gulags. And your point about, historical nuance is really well taken.
I just was going to say that with history is a study of change over time, and a conservative disposition is. You could almost summarize it by kind of talking about a conservative as someone who has a particular view of change. Conservatives are often sort of characterized or caricaturized by the left as people who don't want change, who want just the status quo, like a traditionalist. But that's not true at all. Conservatives recognize that change is inevitable. Change is a part of life. Change is a part of the natural order of things. But the genius of the American constitutional system is that it allows for radical changes, huge changes over the long course of time. But the Constitution is rooted in something that doesn't change, and that is a recognition of what human nature is comprised of. It's comprised of at least two things. It's comprised of human dignity. We're created in the image of God. So think Psalm 8. But on the other hand, it's in tension with the fall. We are depraved. So think Isaiah 59, think Romans 3, Romans 6. That tension exists. And but those that tension isn't going to go away. It doesn't change. So America of 1963 can be different than America of 2025. But the First Amendment is predicated on that human nature, something that doesn't change. So it's still going to be applicable. Whereas a totalitarian system is always going to be rooted in the historical moment. So take fascism for a second. Paul Gottfried, in his book on fascism, one of the things that he argues is that fascism is sort of confined to a particular moment in time, a particular historical context in Europe, in the wake of the defeat of the Central Powers in the First World War and the onset of a destructive global depression in the wake of that defeat in the 20s and the 30s. That's the fertile ground that brings forth fascism. But fascism like that can't exist now because we're so far beyond that. The world is so different than that now. The world has moved on. And this is an example of how the Constitution is supple. The Constitution bends and sort of has this give to allow for the change. But it's rooted in something that it is unchanging. It's rooted in a tradition that's unchanging. Whereas totalitarianism is always going to be located in a historical context. It's not supple, it's brittle. And when it breaks, it is bloody, it is destructive. It's the situation where thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people die. And that's not something that we want to see.
Here's that's very well said. This is a great paragraph you have toward the end of the book, and we'll point people to it and give you the last word, page 219. If we're going to be conservatives, and if we are going to conserve the American tradition of harmonizing religion and liberty through public spirit, then we must know what a conservative is and what conservatives value. In other words, we must know what conservatives are before we can know what conservatives do. The aspirational conservative is pre-political. And I so appreciate that point. It's not anti-political, but it's pre-political. And if we only think doing something means political action, we're missing the more important point. The one possessing a conservative disposition, you write, aims for a higher moral destiny for persons and societies, guided by the light of permanent things, tradition, and just order. He understands human fallibility in the real world. He reckons with the human condition marked as it is by limitation, imperfection, and change. The moral profit and ordered liberty of the human person is the primary consideration of the conservative disposition. For those goods to obtain in the real world of scarcity, sin, and death, we must heed the proven experience of generations past that reveals to us how we understand concepts like rights, freedoms, and ethics. We turn our backs on the past and on tradition at our peril. So well said that this ordered liberty, this moral profit, these are the primary considerations. This is the conservative disposition. As you said, it's not first of all a political package, a political party. Parties change, parties orient themselves to different philosophies. But this idea of conservatism is to realize we live in a real world, scarcity. You said earlier, compared to what is always a great question. Remember, there's this famous clip on the Phil Donahue show of Milton Friedman, and they're talking about greed in capitalism. And Milton Friedman says, "Tell me a society that has no greed." He's not defending greed. He says, "You don't think they're greedy in Soviet Russia? You don't think there's greed?" So it's always, and he does it so well, all 4 foot 10 or whatever his stature was. And you make a great point there. We live in the real world of scarcity, of sin, of death, and we can think of what a heavenly world will be like. And I think the Bible teaches us that that heavenly reality is to find expression as much as possible in the church. That's where we find it. In the state, there are more limited aims and limited ends, and I think that's part of the conservative tradition as well. So give us a last word, John. What is the most important takeaway you want people from this book, Religious Freedom, A Conservative Primer? What do you hope people will do or understand from this book?
I want people to have a reinvigorated enthusiasm for the American constitutional tradition. America is not perfect, But it was never designed to be. It was never aimed to be perfect. It was aimed to be the best possible polity system that we could come up with. The authors of the Federalist Papers, Hamilton, Jay, Madison, they expressed as much. They conceded that this was not a perfect system. But it is proven to be over 200 plus years to be the best system that human minds could come up with. Not perfect, flawed. And it's wrong to say it doesn't work, it's failed. That is what Pierre Viereck refers to as adolescent defiance. It's a spirit of adolescent defiance that is rooted in sentimentality and a short view of things, not a long view of things, and not a historically rooted view of things or a traditionally rooted view of things. And so I want conservatives to have a renewed enthusiasm for America and American traditions. I would hope people on the left would look at this book and that they would see the importance of seeing this world in realistic terms, and also to be inspired to look to God, to center their worldview on belief in God, at least to start there, and to recognize that that a leftist view of the world is an anti-human view of the world.
We're talking to John Wilsey, Religious Freedom, a Conservative Primer. So appreciated this conversation, and I hope that. Are you going to be at ETS? Maybe I'll
I'll
see you
be there, man.
there.
I'll be there.
I will be there and look forward to getting to spend some more time together. Keep up the good work. Keep writing these good things. So I encourage everyone, published by Erdmann's, came out last year, and you have a new book coming out. When does that come out? You want to tell us about
It comes
that?
out, yeah, it comes out in February. I believe February 1st is the date. It's called God and Country, Upholding Faith, History, and American Identity. And it's a book about thinking historically and its necessity in order in cultivating a rightly ordered patriotism.
Sounds very good. Well, thank you all for watching or listening. This has been Life and Books and Everything, a ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can get episodes like this, lots of other resources at clearlyreformed.org. So until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.